We are being joined by Dr. William Bill Dave Terrell, and is it Terrell or Ter? How do you pronounce your last name?
It's Terrell.
Terrell, okay. T-E-R-R-I-L-L. And it was interesting because after inviting him to come join us this evening, because Bill is an expert on police deadly use of force and the use of some alternative non-lethal strategies that police use, I was reading my copy of New Scientist over the weekend, and there was Bill Terrell's information included in one of the articles talking about recent research about the opportunities to do empathy training with police. Mm-hmm. And that really what we need to be thinking about, you know, one of the challenges, you know, I come out of this background of community policing, I keep hearing in the news all the time, well, here's the quick solution, we just need to do more training. Well, what kind of training? You know, it makes a big difference what you're training officers to do. We were just talking now, it was today that apparently a homeless man in Los Angeles was shot to death by the LAPD. And we see these incidents occurring and we see this discussion. What is your findings about? What are the gaps in training or problems in training that seem to be allowing more of these incidents to happen?
Well, I think training from a police academy perspective is still focused predominantly on the law enforcement role. And so when you have that sort of ideology being translated from a training perspective, you know, the community policing, the empathy side of the equation gets lost. And so, you know, the idea that community policing from a training perspective is still much more of that rhetoric than reality.
Oh, absolutely.
The training academy is predominantly driven by, you know, on the gun range, how to do high-speed traffic stops or high-speed pursuits. It's the danger side of the role that's played out so much more than the social welfare role of the police. And of course, anyone that's been a police officer or has studied the police understands that the bulk of what a police officer does is not enforce the law, not invoke the arrest. It's dealing with the social welfare role, the order maintenance side of the equation. And so I think it's difficult sometimes for police organizations because they're geared around the critical incident as opposed to what the norm of policing is. And
I remember the Kansas City Preventive Patrol study that was done decades ago. It was 70s, 80s.
Early 70s.
Yeah, early 70s. And what they did was they looked at how the police handled critical incidents in the community. And basically, they divided up Kansas City into different quadrants. And they put double the number of patrol cars in one, figuring that, well, it will take down things like street crime because you'll have all these officers out there patrolling in their patrol cars. They took another section of the city and they said, we're only going to send in a car when there's a 911 call. And of course, police are organized around this whole rapid response because if your life is in danger, you want an officer there as quickly as possible. The fact that's only 3% of calls, well, 97% are on other things, but we're organized to get them there. So in that case, there was even some concern about whether that was safe to leave the community that unprotected while they did the study, and the third part just had normal patrol. And what they found out was it didn't make any difference.
No effect.
At all?
None.
None.
I mean, it's
that's hard to chew, isn't it?
It is, and wow. It was a startling study because everybody thought that you would see this dramatic decrease, and it was really, the study was done to be able to justify and put resources at the federal level into improving the number of officers on patrol in these patrol cars. And that's what they're trained to do. But the reality is that's not what the job is. If you're committing a street crime, if you're shaking somebody down and grabbing their wallet, you can tell when that patrol car is out there. You wait for the lights to go around the corner, you know, and that's when you knock the guy over the head and grab the wallet. So it didn't make any difference. And really, in some ways, that was sort of the spark to rethinking, what are we doing? What are we having officers out there to do?
Well, the benefit, you know, from that study and a couple of small replication studies found similar findings was that it helped kind of spawn the community policing era, which was great. But here we are in 2015, and, you know, I just taught my undergraduate policing class today at Michigan State, and you know, we discussed that most police agencies across the country are still going out to their cars, getting in and randomly driving around as they were. You know, there's no evidence that this random preventative vehicle patrol has an effect on crime.
Biggest
and
waste
yet
of time. And
we still do it. Karl Clocker, a famous sociologist, made the comparison saying, you know, it makes about as much sense to have cars driving around randomly to prevent crime as it would be have firefighters driving around a fire truck attempting to prevent fire.
Yes.
And bluntly, the way policing is still organized and the way service is delivered to the public. Now, the 911 system has a lot to do with that. Of, you know, dial a cop is a big part of it.
And one of the things that we tried to do when we tried to go in and do police reform was to reform the 911 call priority system. So in order to free up time, to leave an officer enough time in a community to interact with people, we would say, well, you know, if you come home from vacation and you find your lawnmower gone, streaking an officer to your door within 5 minutes isn't going to make the difference between success and failure in your stolen lawnmower. But if we can save that kind of rapid response, save time in that system by not having to have an officer free to get there fast, what we can do is we can station an officer in a neighborhood storefront somewhere who finds out who the kids are that are cutting school, that are they're busy fencing the lawnmower, you know, or who are doing these kinds of things, so that you have somebody in the community, and they actually do know. We know that such a small percentage of crime is ever reported to the police. It's never the majority of the crime in the community, that we need to have officers out there who are interacting with people who know what's going on and who know the bad actors from the people you can trust, who can mobilize people to help you. When we did community policing the way we wanted to do it, what we had were people in the community coming to the aid of an officer who would get into trouble. Nowadays, I think in some cases they'd run the other way because they don't want to be involved.
Yeah, and I think with community policing, we've lose sight, the agencies that attempt, it's about creating those positive contacts with community members, not only the reactive negative contacts. And today I got a copy of the release of the interim report of the President's 21st task force that was created by President Obama. And it really talks about those, you know, getting to a point again and rethinking these positive contacts, not just the negative. And that's very much the underpinnings of some of the early principles of community policing that I think have got lost over the years.
I used to work with the former chief in Tulsa, Drew Diamond. He was with the Police Executive Research Forum, and we used to go around the country doing anti-violence work involving community policing. And he said one of the first changes that he always asked to make was to change the name from police officer to peace officer. Because he said, if you think of the role of the old-fashioned peace officer, the person who was the county sheriff out in the West, he said, first of all, what happened when you came to town? You had to turn over your guns to the county sheriff because you couldn't take your gun into the bar. Radical idea. What happened to that old Second Amendment back in the old Wild West days? We thought that was pretty ripped.
You couldn't read.
Well, maybe that was it, but they had a sign behind the bar, no guns allowed, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, they were peace officers. Their job was to keep the peace. It was not to solve crime. But there is a certain kind of mindset, and I think part of it goes to recruiting, where we have made this crime solving,
crime
the
fighting.
CSI,
yep.
People coming in, all this. We've made that so noble and so exciting that we're leading people into coming into a job that isn't really there.
Well, you know, one of the things that, and I experienced that when I used to run at Lansing Community College every day for 20 years, I guess, they trained the office, police officers here, so they were always in the locker room with us. It was a pretty scary experience because they were there for the adrenaline rush. You could sense it. It was all about that. And that's what gets them in trouble a lot of times, is that rush.
The esprit de corps, the cultural features of policing, of maintaining the edge, controlling an encounter with the public as opposed to having a dialogue and, you know, treating everyone as if they're a suspect accused of wrongdoing. And that leads to danger. And, you know, some of my recent research has kind of brought out the positives and negatives of college-educated police officers.
Ah.
And, you know, some of the drawbacks of is we're finding, you know, we did a national study involved 8 cities, and we found that officers that have a 4-year degree have higher jobs. They're frustrated with their job. So they're less satisfied with their job, and they're also less satisfied with their management. So they're college educated, you know, this idea of just following the rules, they want to discuss it, they want to problem solve, they want to use the analytical side of the equation. But the structure of policing is still set up in that quasi-military structure, policy, procedures, you know, kind of the military model But the flip side, the positive, is we're finding that those with a college degree are less likely to use force and less likely to use higher levels of force, controlling for a whole host of situational factors. So the if you think of the way that policing is structured in America, we take the least experienced officers right out of the academy and put them in the most difficult to policing circumstances, on the night shift in the high crime areas. So you can only get experience by being on the street for a while, but if educated officers are better at using force to police the public, then you can, you know, that's a beneficial feature right out of the academy, that they could be placed in these types of situations.
And no matter how good the academy is, a lot of that washes out depending on who the officer is that's training that young rookie. What concerned me the last time I guest lectured in one of the CJ classes at MSU, when my friend Frank Horvath, who I think went out there and is busy polygraphing people I don't even want to know, but I was guest lecturing for him, and a discussion came up about hitting a child. And I had too many people in the room who were planning on becoming police officers who were very much about how that's the only way you can teach children. You have to beat them. You need to use a belt. And I was really getting horrified as I was hearing some of this, because we have recruited people into the field who I think, unfortunately, are not the ones attuned to understanding that these problems are far more complex. I thought of that the other day when that young woman said, "We can't kill our way out of these wars." I think, you know, you can't just use muscle in communities and solve crime. And that's part of the mistake, I think, that we're running into, is this mindset that somehow we can just stamp out crime. What we've ended up with is 2.3 million people behind bars, a completely unsustainable and expensive system that returns people who are more dangerous than they were when they went in. And we're doing things that are counterproductive. I think we have to start doing smarter policing in addition to community policing. What would you want to see happen? If you could run the system, what kinds of incentives or changes would you implement?
Well, I think the educational incentive is a good part of it, but I think we have to introduce the human element into policing and embed that from a cultural perspective. Instead of this badge of honor that I'm part of kind of the old boys network, and earlier study I did was fascinating in the perspective of, we looked at officers' attitudes, and we found that officers that bought into kind of the traditional cultural features of policing were much more likely to use force and higher levels of it. But those officers that we called con officers, they were opposite of the traditional culture. They were more community policing oriented. They didn't distrust citizens just because they were citizens. They were able to police the public in a less coercive way. And then that snowballs into more trust from the community, more legitimacy from the police agency. The public is more willing to share information with them. And that's positive policing. And I think trying to get that mindset culturally is important, but it has to start with the education. It has to be threaded throughout training academy, and once they get into the organization, it can't be forget everything that you learned in the academy.
Right.
We're going to show you how it's really done, and that's this kind of heavy-handed tactic. It has to be supportive, top-down.
This is LCC Radio, WLNZ 89.7 here in Lansing, Michigan.
I'm wondering, with this accelerated move to put body cameras on, is that going to temper attitudes in some way?
I fear that the rush to body cameras is seen, we're always looking for that silver bullet, right? That panacea in policing. We thought when it was force, it was going to be taser, that citizens were going to stop resisting all of a sudden and the taser was going to neutralize. And we're finding out that actually tasers aren't as effective as they're told to be, and they actually may cause death in some cases. And I fear with body cameras, I don't think they're going to be that panacea that's going to stop citizens from resisting or officers from being coercive. I think it's a tool that could be useful, but I hope it doesn't get overplayed. There's so many police departments rushing to implement cameras right now, and we know virtually nothing about the effects of them. Some anecdotal studies here and there, but departments are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to implement the police force, and they have no idea whether they work or even what the goal is. Is it to reduce citizen complaints?
That is so typical of government spending, however, is that, you know, if you can buy something that's going to solve the problem, and that's going to be what they're going to go for first because it's easy. I used to consult with the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. I used to write diversity training for them. And they got very hot on these simulators. Boy, buy a $50,000 simulator, train an officer when to shoot. I looked at some of the scenarios. You know, when they have the woman pulling a gun out of the baby's diaper,
that's right?
What they're teaching you is, shoot the woman, you can't trust anybody.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, Seriously. And so they basically, the whole bottom line was, you can't trust anybody, shoot them all, sort it out later. And we're seeing the consequences of some of that kind of training. That's what concerns me. What we really have had, too, I think, is this culture of escalation. It is considered unmasculine to de-escalate a situation. And one of the things that we found was very difficult, I worked on a project with the Violence Against Women Office, developing curriculum on community policing and violence against women. We gave training to a group of officers. They were what I would have considered the cream of the crop, but this was our test training. And at the end of that, we asked them about a scenario that had actually occurred in their department, where a husband and wife team who were both with the department, he had beaten her up. And that was quite an incident, and there was a lot of concern because it was at the time there was a lot of controversy about taking the guns away from domestic violence, you know, people who commit sure. domestic violence. Well, that would mean he couldn't have a job. That group, their consensus was he should be allowed to be a police officer, but she shouldn't. And she shouldn't because she had been a victim, and she would take the side of the victims out there, and she would be on the side of the women, so we should not let her go back out into the field. Now, that was the strangest reaction, and this was after our training. So I was concerned that, I mean, how do you... We tried to do diversity training, and I think in many ways we failed. We tried to do empathy training. Elsie Scott, who was the head of the NYPD training office, she said to me once, she said, you know, I'm worried about any time an officer goes back under stress, they revert back to behaviors from 10 years ago.
All right.
How do we, what kind of training, how can we train people to be more empathetic?
Well, I think in terms of empathy, to getting recruits and then cadets to understand that, you know, I think in policing, there's this understanding that everything's about free will. People freely choose to resist the police and so forth. And so understanding the broader, you know, when a police officer goes into a public housing site, instead of immediately seeing that person as unworthy or deservedness aspect to it, to say, you know, there's various features from a socioeconomic standpoint that go on here that I'm not just going to label that person as bad in some way, that... there, you know, if you go back to William Muir's book where he talks about empathy, and a good police officer is someone that can use force but can apply empathy in the process of that. And so understanding that sometimes people are in situations and may react a certain way, that's not simply because they're trying to get you as a police officer, or they're out to dominate you because they don't want to be disrespected. It's that, you know, they're in a situation that is beyond their control. It's not just free will. And the escalation, de-escalation, again, I don't think there's enough, you know, there's a famous saying in policing now that one comes to understand violence by studying violence. And I think we study violence and these situations that eventuate into violence, and we don't pay enough attention to those situations that could escalate, and the police are able to de-escalate it. They don't show up on YouTube. They don't show up in a video that goes viral, right? I think we need to start studying nonviolence and those procedures that officers, that skilled officers can employ to essentially police in a non-coercive or a less coercive way.
In my experience, and it's purely anecdotal, I found that there were a lot more women officers who didn't seem to have their ego on the line in the same way that the male officers did when they were challenged by a citizen. And they were quicker to de-escalate. They had better verbal skills. They seemed to have more rhetoric in their arsenal. They're talkers, basically, and so they were able to talk their way out of situations that others, I think, would have escalated into something really ugly. And I guess I was always just surprised. It's the old, if all you, you know, if all you're given is a hammer, you think everything, you know, you just hit it with that, hit that nail. Mm-hmm. I was walking the beat in Grand Rapids with two police officers who were, you know, I wasn't fond of the idea they had them walk in pairs. I think they should have had them walk alone. If you can't, if you're too afraid to walk alone in the neighborhood, there's something wrong with them. You know, you're not doing your job as a police officer, because it should be safer than that. But they kept telling me they had this kid they really wanted to save because he was a bright kid, personable kid. They really liked him, but they could see him falling in with a bad crowd. And I said, so what are you doing about that? They said, well, we hassle him every time we see him. We throw him against the wall. We tell him. And I said, have you thought about reaching out to the minister or the teacher or going over and talking to the parents and saying, are you having trouble? Have you thought about... And they looked at me like I was from Mars. I mean, and it was like, but I could see a sort of glimmer of light. And I think that's part of what's missing from the training.
And I think some agencies are getting better at that. More and more agents. We were surprised with some of the cultural features we found in our 8-city study, that officers are more in tune with some of the community elements. And I think that is process. Now, overcoming that broader cultural organizational aspect is extremely difficult. If you're not buying into it, you know, in the traditional culture, you're still kind of on the outside looking in, and you're not deemed to be kind of the cop's cop. Right.
Oh, absolutely.
You know that phrase, the best police chief still, oh, he's a cop's cop. That's a badge of honor. And, you know,
it's
I think
what
we
makes
need to
me
turn
so uncomfortable about Bill Bratton. The only time I've had an opportunity to talk with Bratton, I argued with him about broken windows. And I said, if you turn broken windows into community harassment policing, we're going to lose the ballgame.
Right.
And he got really angry with me. It's the last time he ever talked to me. We were having a telephone conversation. And I tried to give him the example that I'd watched two agencies do the same thing. And it was related to poor people not having a lawnmower and the grass grows. One agency decided that it was community policing to go in and ticket those people immediately, and you know, the fines double. And pretty quickly all you're doing is you're really harassing the poor because they don't have the money to pay you. It's like debtor's prison. Now they've got a record. Now they've got all this stuff against them. The other community policing officer went out and got the community to donate, and they bought a used lawnmower. And they got kid volunteers to go and mow the lawns of the elderly people and the people that didn't have the money for the gas. And they solved the problem in the community so that the community looked better, the grass was mowed, they got rid of the litter, but they didn't do it by harassing people. And to me, it's that mindset difference that has to happen.
Completely, yeah. It's just punitive. And even internally, organizations have that. I mean, officers, you know, they get complaints, and it immediately, instead of using that as kind of a learning component, it goes as a complaint in the file in the personnel, and it's usually used as a punitive. So that distrust comes out from the officer's perspective towards management, and then that translates to the community, and everything is the punitive. Again, some agencies are good. I just did a ride along in Madison, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. with a former student, and remarkable of how they think of the positive side of the equation.
David Cooper was one of the originators.
That's right. Early on the community policing
side. So they've managed to maintain it there.
They've maintained it. They are very good at we responded to a call that involved a knife and a roommate trying to attack another roommate with a knife. And the four officers showed up, they had a knife. And before you knew it, that person didn't have a knife anymore, and no one put their hands on the suspect.
Really?
They had the verbal skills to get that person to put the knife down.
So that's what we should be recording for TV.
It would have warranted a deadly force justification, but no one even knew, none of the four officers drew their weapon.
The police chiefs that I liked were the ones who wouldn't let cops come into their community. Because they said cops did a lot to reinforce this idea of the macho police officers running after people and that that's what the job is. And it attracts the wrong kind of people. You know, my late boss, Bob Trajanowicz, who was out there at Michigan State, much revered in the field, he always said what the police officer's job is, you need Mother Teresa with a gun. I mean, they're the only people who can use deadly force. I mean, they have the right to do it. They're the only people authorized in the society domestically to use deadly force. And it ought to be rare, but it ought to be handled by somebody who really is a problem solver and not a bully. We had too many times that I went out and faced situations where, to be honest about it, especially when I saw LAPD and what they were doing with gangs, they were becoming a gang. They were a gang in blue. That was a real concern of mine. I mean, there's a sort of mindset in some of the departments. I was out there once at a conference. They invited me to speak at the Western Journalism Conference out there, and one of the assistant chiefs said, "Why do you think that community policing never took here?" And I said, "Well, you know, you have so few officers." At that time, they had 8,000 officers. New York City had 38,000. You have no choice but to do military policing if you don't have enough people. So part of it is putting in resources too, isn't it?
Yes, and you know, LAPD was able to convince the cops office to fund one of their projects under community policing now for SWAT.
See, yes.
Now, if there's not a bigger disconnect between community policing and SWAT, I don't know what it is.
Officer-friendly SWAT.
you're officer-friendly, right, with a sniper.
This is LCC Radio, WLNZ 89.7. We're talking with Bill Terrell, and I have to tell you that I was the grant reviewer on one of the grants that Washington was giving out of the cops office. And one of the departments in Texas had applied, and here was how they were going to implement community policing. They were going to go in at first, and they were going to station officers on the sidewalk, and they were going to stop every pedestrian and ask for ID. And even if you weren't driving, if you didn't have a license, and you, or you didn't, weren't willing to show it to the officer, they would cuff you and take you to the station. And they said, after 6 months of this, we feel we'll have a real relationship with the community where then we can go in and start working on crime. And I thought, you'll be lucky if any officers are left after you do that to the community for 6 months. I mean, there's a sort of, you could, they were applying the term community policing to anything after a while.
To anything. Community policing became this catch-all because it was linked with money.
Right.
It was linked with federal money. And so if you could work it in, that's, you worked it in. And so if you look on, you know, side of patrol cars and mission standards, community policing, because that was an attempt to grasp the resources that were available. And then, of course, the studies that have looked at community policing in most of the agencies, it becomes, you know, a token, you know, a couple bike units, a couple foot units, and then you look in 90% of the organizations still operating, same old,
yeah.
Which is that professional military.
Changes. That's There's
right.
no change in incentives.
Correct.
One of the things, there was an article in the New York Times on Sunday about the University of Detroit's police squad.
When they used to have the mini stations, you mean?
Well, no, this was about...
Oh, the jump-out squads.
They're using surveillance.
Oh.
Surveillance cameras. It's probably the most highly surveilled place in the country.
They put those in a long time ago.
In Midtown.
Yeah.
And they say they're the best at it. Does that, now, and it seemed like it was accepted by the community.
In England, and we imported it. We have a very different culture than England does. And I can see a role for it, but the reason that I went up against Lansing investing in it, number one, they weren't going to have anybody watching it in real time. It was just simply going to be used as a court tool later. Of all the things to spend money on in an era when money was so tight, it seemed to me that going back to community policing and providing some training in that area would give you much bigger bang for the buck. Because if you can take that multiplier effect of stationing one officer out in a troubled neighborhood and let them interact with the people in the community, you have all that community behind you working with you. And what they were brilliant about doing, as I'm sure you know here in Lansing, was that Bill, you know, Bob and I were talking about neighborhood network centers. Mm-hmm. Get other social service delivery people so you've got a wraparound approach so that when you do find the kid in trouble, you can move in with a whole community team and say, how can we save this kid?
You know, the other thing, I'm at the library downtown a lot, and urban libraries are always like this. They attract an unusual audience.
Yeah.
I was thinking the other day, this would be a perfect place for a substation.
Absolutely.
There would be no problems there, and you talk with people all the time.
Well, you know what my friend Drew Diamond did down in Tulsa was he figured out the same thing. He was getting all these complaints from the library. So he went to all of the businesses in town, and he raised $11 million to have a day center for the homeless. He said, we put them in shelters at night, but if you give them any services during the day, you demand that they be drug-free and alcohol-free. And he said, that's ridiculous. They're not going to be drug-free.
Unrealistic.
He said, the people running the ones who are signing the checks aren't drug-free and alcohol-free. Why would you think the people that you're serving will be? You know, I mean, I would go to these meetings in Washington, and they would say, we got a break now. It's cocktail hour. And I think, okay. And it was the drug task force, you know. I mean, so it's a strange thing, but you can do that. You can use those facilities. We need more storefront neighborhood facilities, and we tend to.
The thing at U of D too, just so people know, is they were real time. They were using it.
They were
real
using it the way you're supposed to. Mm.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it brought the community into it.
Mm. Yeah. But I mean, we're seeing that the city of Detroit was an example of. I mean, can you de-escalate population that dramatically, lose hundreds of thousands of people in the tax base, and make the community safer? You can't
do it. And have one of the largest geographical areas in the country, if not the largest.
Yeah.
Maybe Houston's bigger, Dallas-Fort Worth, but Detroit is gigantic.
It is. Physically gigantic.
I mean, you can put Manhattan inside it.
And you have
easily,
the history of the riots, and you have the history of the Malice Green case down there. You have some really ugly history that I think makes it difficult to think about.
Yeah, see, I don't know how you do community policing in Detroit. Now, there's a... Because it's so gigantic.
Well, we had those mini stations, and they were a great opportunity, but they weren't staffed properly. They would put the troubled problem officers in them as a punishment.
As a punishment. You've hit it right on the head, yeah. Everything gets turned around.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, Flinch tried to introduce some more community policing again through some Mott Foundation funding. But there, certain jurisdictions, Detroit, Flint, get to a certain point of a threshold effect that they're scrambling just to get some officers on the street on any given shift. I mean, the personnel allocation on regular patrol is so low and they have such big areas now that they're just trying to survive.
Mott gave millions to Flint and said, because they wanted to be a good neighbor to Flint, they gave, you know, Trojo set up the 64 beat areas in that community. Well, the promise was that these would be additional officers who would be added on top of the existing system. If you look at the number of officers in the department when the grant started and when the grant ended, it actually went down just a little. Okay. They never did get any extra officers. And so that became pulling officers from other assignments in many cases that left other areas that weren't being served. So it's always a problem with resources.
Always. I mean, you faced it back in, that was the 80s.
Yeah.
And the same thing, the funding came along for extra officers, and they just got filtered into regular patrol because the resources were so low. And so 30 years different, same thing going on.
We had the collapse of the manufacturing economy as jobs moved overseas, and what we really saw was that I thought crack cocaine became the Amway of the inner city. Then it became a multi-level marketing scheme, and to be honest about it, the smart people went into it because there weren't many other options. And I saw the kind of violence. I did anti-violence training in 60 different public housing developments across the country. And what you saw were parents literally putting their kids to bed at night in bathtubs, hoping that that would stop the bullets coming through the door. It was that kind of an era. We had 22,000 homicides that year. We have 15, 16,000 now in a much larger population. It was a truly violent era. So community policing played a role in reducing that. But if you look back historically, we kind of lost the ball game. Because I think when 2001 came along, 9/11, we returned, we were so fearful, we went back to a military model. And I think when the economic collapse came along, that solidified it even more. So,
can I ask a really, this is a naive question, but why aren't the mayors, the city managers, demanding different organizational structures for police departments, because it's the most costly thing in our...
Look how popular Bill de Blasio's become with the police by doing that.
Okay, that answers my question.
See, they love him.
You can rest your case.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then compare him to Rudy Giuliani and how the police viewed him with his style and support of the police, with Bratton as his police chief. Cop's cop.
But Bratton got so popular that Giuliani fired him because he was afraid he'd run for mayor. So, well, I mean, that's always the tension between the police chief and the mayor, isn't it?
Always. I mean, that power struggle, I mean, that's usually where it occurs.
But, you know, I remember staying up late at the FBI Academy one night with a chief from Indiana who said, you know, I was asking him about excessive force, and he said, I had a guy, and I said, he worked midnights, and he said, I knew he was a troubled guy. He said, and, you know, I should have dealt with him, and I didn't. And he tried to murder the girlfriend that he had. He was married. He tried to burn her up in the house. He went and shot some officers who were coming to try to save her. And he said, I always felt guilty about that because he said, that was on my watch. He said, I was always promoting the good officers, but the hardest thing in the world is to deal with the ones we've got to get rid of. And we know they're there.
Yep.
And I think maybe that's one other place where police need to put some energy.
It is. You know, a lot of chiefs decry the struggles they have with police unionization and actually being able to fire. So, I mean, I've seen some jurisdictions where the police chief is very, you know, proactive of firing the troubled officer that then is brought back.
Right.
And so, you know, I did a civil case and an officer had shot his weapon 3 times in 1 year. He was involved in a DUI accident that killed a woman. He fired the officer. And the officer was brought back through the negotiation process.
And we know that's going to be trouble.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill Terrell. This has been a wonderful discussion. Gladdens my heart to see people in the field giving this kind of instruction to that next generation coming up.